Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Ballot battle. The Senate begins debate on voting rights, even as Republicans remain united in opposing the legislation and any efforts to allow a simple majority to rule. Then, COVID surge calls for new approaches to managing the virus grow louder as hospitals struggle and parents of young children navigate an uncertain time. And economy in a tailspin. Skyrocketing inflation grips Turkey as its president implements unorthodox countermeasures.
Anyone who took Econ 101 in college would know if your inflation climbs up, interest rates have to follow that. Erdogan is doing the opposite.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The Biden administration's website for requesting free at-home COVID tests is now open for business. It went online today, a day ahead of the officially scheduled launch. The website, covidtest.gov, allows four tests to be ordered per residential address. We'll focus on federal efforts to deal with COVID after the news summary. The U.S. Senate formally opened debate today on voting rights legislation with little prospect of passing anything. Democrats want to expand voting access, increase regulation of campaign financing, and challenge states that they say restrict voting rights. Republicans say it is federal overreach, and they plan to block action. Again, party leaders sparred on the Senate floor.
Senate Democrats are under no illusion that we face difficult odds, especially when virtually every Senate Republican is staunchly against legislation protecting the right to vote. Sadly, unfortunately, this is Donald Trump's Republican Party, and it is the one now trying to take away the vote.
The partisan election takeover bills that Democrats want to ram through this week are not in any way successors of the civil rights legislation from the mid-20th century. Targeting Americans' online speech and sending government money to political campaigns is not about civil rights, it's about tilting the playing field.
Democrats say they will seek to change Senate rules so that Republicans cannot block a simple majority vote, but it's unlikely they can muster the votes for that either. We'll return to this later in the program. A congressional committee subpoenaed former Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani today in the January 6th investigation. He pushed baseless claims of voter fraud after the 2020 election and leading up to the assault on the U.S. Capitol. The panel also subpoenaed several others, including lawyers Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis. A federal judge has approved a debt restructuring plan ending Puerto Rico's struggle to emerge from bankruptcy. It cuts the U.S. territory's public debt of at least $74 billion by 80%. Local leaders today called it a big step forward. Opponents said that it will force new austerity measures. Warnings flew back and forth today between Russia and NATO powers over Ukraine. That's after talks last week ended with no progress. Today in Berlin, NATO's Secretary General met with Germany's new chancellor and said the danger of a Russian attack on Ukraine is rising.
The risk of a conflict is real. NATO allies call on Russia to de-escalate, and any further aggression will come with a high cost for Moscow. NATO is a defensive alliance which does not threaten Russia or any other country.
But in Moscow, after a meeting with Germany's foreign minister, the Russian foreign minister said the risk is from NATO moves near Russia's borders.
We don't threaten anybody with anything, but we do hear the threats addressed to us. I hope it only reflects certain emotions that certain powers incite within the Western camp. We will act in accordance with concrete steps and concrete actions.
Russia also announced that it's sending troops to Belarus for war games, adding to its forces deployed near Ukraine. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with Foreign Minister Lavrov, and they agreed to meet Friday in Geneva. Verizon and AT&T agreed today to delay activating 5G cell towers near major airports. The new wireless technology will speed up service, but airlines warn that it could interfere with instruments measuring distance to the ground. Major carriers had threatened to ground or delay flights. Their announcement followed talks with the White House. In Texas, the nation's most restrictive abortion law may stay in effect longer as a legal challenge continues. A federal appeals court now says that a judge who already ruled against the law will not review it again. Instead, it goes to the Texas Supreme Court, controlled by Republican justices. The new law bans abortions at about 6 weeks of pregnancy. And on Wall Street, stocks tumbled on fears of higher interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 543 points, 1.5%, to close at 35,368. The Nasdaq fell 386 points. That's more than 2.5%. The S&P 500 slid 85 points. That's 1.8%. Still to come on the NewsHour, the food security emergency in Afghanistan grows ever more dire amid a harsh winter. Microsoft makes a big bet on gaming. The science behind a massive volcanic eruption in the Pacific, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
This week marks a full year since President Biden took office. That also means the president has had broad responsibility for the federal response to the pandemic for a year. There's plenty of data to suggest that things are not going well at this moment. Cases are surging in many parts of the country, with nearly 800,000 new cases a day. Hospitalizations and deaths are up significantly compared to 2 weeks ago. There are close to 140,000 people admitted to the hospital in total with confirmed COVID right now. And the country is reporting more than 1,700 deaths a day now. There have been calls for shifting the administration's strategy. That includes several articles written by former advisors to the president. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is a lead of that group of public health experts. He's the vice provost of global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins me now. Zeke Emanuel, welcome back to the NewsHour. So tell us, why is a new approach needed?
Well, the Biden administration came in a year ago with a strategic plan, and it executed very well on that plan. Got more people vaccinated, got more tests out to the community, began developing other interventions for the public. And then we had cases come down in June, but we developed Delta, we developed Omicron, and the people in the administration have been working hard to address those acute problems. And they do marshal in and require us to rethink the direction of interventions and how we deploy everything together. And that was really the source of our viewpoints.
So what would this new approach look like? How would it be different?
Well, first of all, we have to get there. As you pointed out, we have 1,750 or so deaths a day. We're nowhere near getting to a new normal. But we can see that we're not going to eradicate COVID. We're going to have to live with it. And living with it means we have to take measures that allow it to be in the background and not causing so much mortality. And so part of this is, you know, we have to make sure that we have good air filtration in all indoor spaces, an issue which we have not heavily emphasized, but can make a big difference. Improve that filtration of air. We do have to improve our vaccine distribution. One of the reasons we're having so many hospitalizations and so many people in the intensive care unit and such high deaths is that a lot of people are not becoming vaccinated. And most of those people are ending up, or the people ending up in the hospital are mostly unvaccinated. If you're vaccinated and boosted, your chance of dying from getting Omicron, 1 in 34,000. That is very, very safe. And we have to get more people vaccinated. And plus, we need more therapies. We have a couple of nice oral antiviral therapies against COVID, but we need more And we need more volume of them. So those are some of the areas that will get there. And the new normal will look like the old normal.
If I could just stop you there, Zeke Emanuel, I want to pick up on what you said about vaccinations. I mean, how would you have the administration up the number of people vaccinated? They've obviously been pleading with Americans to get vaccinated. It's become a political issue. And now you have the Supreme Court ruling just a few days ago against the administration's requirement that large employers have people vaccinated, employees vaccinated.
Well, first of all, we do have to get all those healthcare workers vaccinated. The Supreme Court did deal a very severe blow to responding to this pandemic, and I think the ruling was just unjustifiable. The federal government clearly has authority to protect people, and people in their workplace are threatened by COVID. So the federal government has to try other things. It has to target the workplace vaccine requirements. It probably has to make a requirement on air travel, train travel, bus travel that's interstate that it can control. It's got to work with states to mandate vaccination for children when we're convinced that the vaccines are totally safe for them. These are important areas in which we can make progress in. And it really has to work with employers. Again, it can't mandate them, but it has to work with them. We've seen a lot of employers where things have gotten much better when they vaccinate their people. More people show up to work, they have safer work environments, and you know, things go much better. And very few employees who are required to get a vaccine actually quit.
And I hear you saying that that's the ideal, but we also know there is resistance out there, very stubborn resistance that exists. I do want to ask you, though, you said a moment ago, you understand this can't happen, a lot of it right now, because we are dealing with this Omicron wave with deaths and, and hospitalization still at a very high number. So you're saying just to get this ready for the future, is that what you're asking the administration to do?
No, it's not just get ready for the future. Many of the things we suggest will actually address problems now. As I mentioned, you know, getting more people vaccinated, improving air quality, having more people mask will actually both address the problem now and be important for the long term. And I would say, Judy, that disinformation, that misinformation, that resistance to things like vaccines didn't come out of nowhere. It's been fostered by Republicans who have no other response to this pandemic. And that has made it harder for the nation to have an effective response. We do need to counter that, and countering that will require dealing with the social media environment.
Well, of course, that raises a number of other questions, but I do want to ask you about a comment made by one of your public health expert colleagues who was part of putting these public statements, these articles out publicly a few days ago. Dr. Luciana Borio, she's a former chief scientist at the FDA. She said, it feels like we're always fighting yesterday. She's referring to the administration. She said, it feels like we're always fighting yesterday's crisis and not necessarily thinking about what needs to be done today to prepare us for what comes next. In effect, the administration hasn't been thinking forward thinking enough. Is that your observation as well?
Look, Judy, I've been in the trenches in the White House during a crisis in 2009 and 2010, working on the Affordable Care Act. You are just trying to manage all the crises. You need a separate group that is thinking about the strategy and what we can do today for the long term and really make the infrastructure changes we need. And that's what we were suggesting. And that's the suggestions we had for them on strategic goals and how to operationalize those goals. And by the way, they've been very well received.
They are listening to you?
Well, I don't know. We'll find out soon.
Well, we'll be back in touch to find out what the answer is. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Judy. A pleasure to be here.
As Omicron continues its spread, as we've been discussing, children under the age of 5 are still ineligible for vaccinations, leaving many families in limbo, wondering how best to navigate everyday life. Stephanie Tsai has a conversation in a moment about some of these important questions. But let's begin with what we've heard from some parents across the country and how they're coping nearly 2 years into the pandemic.
My name is Lori Sipe Chen, and I live in Oakland, California. I have, I'm a mother of a 3.5-year-old, and we are expecting our second child in about 3 weeks.
My name is Tim Sokaram. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I have 2 kids, ages 4 and 6.
My name is Meg Trelease. I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I have 2 children. I have a 4-year-old girl named Saoirse. My son Beckett is 2, and he has Down syndrome. He is awaiting a heart procedure. He is immunocompromised.
My name is Detresia Taylor. We live in Clarksville, Tennessee. Having a 4-year-old who's not vaccinated when the rest of the house is vaccinated, it's been a little hard as far as traveling and even having people come into the home.
Right now, with the surge, we're continuing to send our child to childcare because we need that help. We both work full time. We're getting ready for a baby, and so keep saying, like, it's trade-offs of life decisions on a week-by-week basis.
He's 4 years old. He's already gotten COVID at daycare, even if and he's been wearing masks as long as he's been back at school. And it seems crazy that he might get it again. Day to day, you kind of just have to fool yourself and say that your kid's not going to be the one that goes to the hospital. Your kid's not going to be the one that gets complications. And I don't know that for sure.
We have family that love us and friends that love us and want to see our kids. But it's like, well, what if we wore a mask? Well, what if we tested? Well, what if we? And I go into these conversations knowing that ultimately I'm going to have to say no. But I enter into them because I don't want to be that person. So we're just literally in our house. And we've been in our house for 2 years. And I feel so beaten down.
It is scary because she continues, you know, a little cold. You're kind of like, oh my goodness, is that what that is? Is it that new variant? Or she's running fever for no reason. It's like you're constantly wondering everything that's happening to her. Could it be that new variant? And if it is, how bad is it going to get for her? Will she have to be hospitalized?
It's really like, what are the risks to my unvaccinated 3.5-year-old? But also, like, are there additional risks to an infant? Like, is there a difference between an infant and like a child, you know, even though they're under 5 and not vaccinated, if there's, you know, some other additional risks that we're taking on? Our 3.5-year-old goes to preschool right now, and they have, you know, safe practices, but it's hard for me to quantify the amount of risk that we're taking on.
My big question is, how is it taking so long for kids under 5 to get approved for a vaccine? Why aren't they more of a priority? It's bad for us parents. We really worried about our kids' health, but they're worried too.
The public health information has been so confusing. I do wish I had a little bit more information on community spread, because right now Philadelphia is hovering at about 40% positivity rate. When is it safe for me to send my unvaccinated 4-year-old back to preschool so that she doesn't bring home COVID and infect my son or herself?
I was able to finally get my 6-year-old vaccinated. So it's like, we're getting there, but we're just waiting for her so we can see family members more often and travel more. We're hoping that something comes down, maybe the age of Laura, even before that time frame. That's what we're looking forward to. We're left in the dark, kind of.
All right, let's try to address some of the concerns of these parents. And for that, I'm joined by Dr. Ibukun Kalu. She's a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Duke University Hospital. And Dr. Ibukun Kalu, I should say, I have my own 3-year-old toddler, so I can relate to some of the anxiety we just heard from those parents. We know Omicron is more contagious. For most vaccinated people, it's more mild. So the key question, I think, for a lot of us parents is, how big of a risk is there of serious illness in our unvaccinated children under 5?
Thank you so much for having me, Stephanie. I hear the frustration, and pediatricians and providers around the country have felt the same as we're trying to tackle how best to keep kids safe, particularly those that are not yet eligible for a vaccine. So to your question as to how severe this is, we've seen more cases in the community, which has meant more kids ending up in the hospital. But we're also seeing milder infections, even in kids. So what that means is we're seeing upper respiratory infections, but for our youngest kids, the infants, even a simple upper respiratory infection could affect their ability to feed, take in milk, for example, or just maintain their typical health status. And so they need a little bit of support for their breathing or for hydration. So that has meant a few more infants in the hospital with COVID.
I'm glad you answered that question about infant, because a parent asked specifically about that. I also want to ask you about immunocompromised children. We heard one parent who has a two-year-old in that situation. How much more dangerous is COVID to that child? And should they avoid sending their children to daycare?
Those questions are so difficult because it really depends on that family situation. You may need to send a child to daycare just to be able to get to work, to be able to manage the household. So ultimately, it depends on if you have options where you can remove a child from daycare or put them in daycare. As much as you can, ensure the daycare setting is safe. So all the eligible adults that are present should be vaccinated and hopefully should get a booster. And particularly for our immunocompromised patients and our youngest immunocompromised patients, I think a lot of people have aimed for protective bubbles, so smaller daycares, fully vaccinated adults, eligible people that are there, masking if at all possible, and ensuring you're preventing other respiratory viruses such as influenza, which has a safe and effective vaccine at this time.
I want to go back to vaccines in a second, but you talked about protocol, safety things that schools and preschools can do for this age group. Is it appropriate to be testing kids this young regularly? Should they be all wearing kid-size N95 masks?
It depends. I think I keep coming back to that answer. I don't necessarily think a kid-size N95 mask is necessary for all our kids. What I think is a properly fitted mask that can stay on that child's face for as long as they'll tolerate it should be the goal. So if you have a mask that has a proper filter, if you have masks that have ties you can tie around the child's head when they go into daycare, I think those are safe and effective. If you have a mask for a child that has N95 properties and the child will keep it on, then it's fine to use it. As to the other question about testing, if they have symptoms, it's good to get a COVID test and maybe even some other testing based on their symptoms. Talk to your provider as soon as you can if you're worried about COVID or other illnesses.
I just want to follow up on that because a lot of parents I've heard from whose young children under 5 have had positive COVID tests have basically reported symptoms of a cold. If your child starts to exhibit symptoms of a cold, should you get them tested?
Yes. Based on our current community rates, it would make sense to at the very least get a test for COVID-19. The chances are high that the common cold could be the presenting symptom for COVID. If you don't have access to a test, and I really hope we get past the point where if you want to get tested, you have to stay in long lines to get tested, you could stay home and monitor the child and communicate the symptoms that are going on with your provider until you can get a test done.
Do you think it should be a priority, Dr. Kalu, of the federal government right now to make the vaccine available to children under 5? We heard from that one dad who thought that would be a good idea. And do we have data on its safety and efficacy at this point?
We're waiting for more data on the clinical trials that have occurred in children less than 5. I think what we know has been based on some media reports and what the companies that are working on this vaccine have provided to us publicly. We know that they're working on it. We know that they had to go back and run this trial for longer, possibly including an additional dose to ensure that whatever that final product is, it actually does what we need it to do, which is protect our youngest kids and help them mount a protective level of antibodies. I don't know the timeline. I certainly think this should be a priority for everybody, and it is a priority for everyone, but I want to also ensure that it's done safely and effectively, and that's what we're all waiting for.
Dr. Ibikun Kalu with the Duke University Hospital, thank you so much for joining us with your advice.
Thank you for your time.
The U.S. Senate officially began debate today on a key Democratic priority, voting rights legislation. But without support from 60 senators, final passage is impossible. Democrats met this evening for an update on the path forward from Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Here with her own update, our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins. So, Lisa, the Democrats were meeting late today. What is the plan?
Some big news tonight in a very big moment for Democrats. Senate Leader Chuck Schumer came out just minutes ago speaking to reporters and unveiling exactly what he intends to do now that it's clear he doesn't have the votes to pass voting rights. He is going to try and change Senate rules for this bill, and I'm going to tell you how. He wants to float the idea of the talking filibuster. That is something that you and I have been talking about on this show. Let me explain what Senator Schumer's proposal is exactly. And again, it would only pertain to this voting rights bill. Essentially, the idea of the talking filibuster is that we require senators to stand and speak while they filibuster, have to continue to hold the floor. It would still require 60 senators to end that filibuster, force an end to debate. But here's the idea that eventually all of the opposing senators would use up their time, would get worn out, and ultimately they would stop speaking on their own. And then at that point, the bill would have just a 51 majority vote threshold. Now, this is an idea that we know Senator Joe Manchin, that critical vote, the Democrat from West Virginia, has said he's interested in. However, just about an hour or so ago, he came out and said he is not on board this plan tonight. For a couple of reasons, he says he still thinks the 60-vote threshold is important for bipartisanship in the Senate, and he also thinks that you should not change it with just one party alone changing the rule. Here's what he said.
The majority of my colleagues in the caucus, Democrat caucus, they've changed. They've changed their mind. I respect that. You have a right to change your mind. I haven't. I hope they respect that, too. I've never changed my mind on the filibuster.
So, Lisa, that doesn't sound promising for Leader Schumer's plan. But what does all this mean for President Biden and for the Democratic agenda?
This is a moment that I think Democrats expected. They knew it, and they've been telling us again and again that they thought this was going to be a very tough hill for them to climb. But that said, don't be fooled. This is a major defeat for Democrats and for the Biden agenda. This means not only that voting rights and all of the possibilities of things like same-day registration, early voting across this country, all of those things that Democrats wanted to do, civil rights protections, those now will not happen. But indeed, other legislation, none of it can happen without 10 Republican senators now on board in the Senate. There is still the exception, potentially, of a reconciliation bill that contains some of that Biden agenda, that Build Back Better idea. We're going to be following that. But Democrats still will need Senators Manchin and Sinema on board that bill. And Senator Schumer still has a needle to thread there. So this is a very big defeat in terms of the muscle that Senate Democrats can mount in not only the U.S. Senate, but in governing in general. It doesn't mean every door is closed to them, but the largest one is.
No question about it, a big victory for Republicans and a significant defeat for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Lisa Desjardins, staying on top of it all. Thank you very much. It has been 5 months since the Taliban took over Afghanistan, and a hard, cruel winter has descended. Millions are in dire need, and not just in the capital, Kabul. John Ray of Independent Television News is there.
There is a timeless side to Afghanistan, resistant to change, resilient in crisis. But this is a test of their deepest reserves. Shafika has her winter larder stored underground. The difference between eating and starvation. This is all we have, she says. Much of this vast land is cut off. The big freeze follows the worst drought in 30 years.
During the long war, this village and so many more like it really were in the front line of the conflict with the Taliban. But now they are at the back of the queue when it comes to help from the international community. There is here absolutely no peace dividend.
The Taliban wants international recognition. It wants aid, but it wants it all on its own terms.
Couldn't you solve this crisis almost straight away by guaranteeing women can go back to education? That would be the clearest indication that the Taliban is committed to human rights.
In respect of women's rights, we never prevented anyone going into education or the workforce, but it must be under the framework of Islamic principles.
A middle class who once fared well under the old regime now struggle. In Kabul, they queue for food.
We have teachers, doctors, engineers who work in the previous government, and now they lose their jobs and they are vulnerable to have the food assistance.
They've got nothing but what they can get here.
Yeah.
Waiting for their sack of flour and single bag of beans is a woman who tells us her daughter was studying to be a doctor, and then the Taliban closed her school. The boys still get to sit exams, even if it is outside in the snow, because their school building is a wreck with no heat or light. They can dream.
My goal ambition in the future, doctor for us people.
This little girl can only watch and wonder what might have been. However deep the crisis, the Taliban will recast this country in its own image. John Ray, ITV News, Kabul.
And as you heard, that report from John Ray of Independent Television News. For Turkey, 2021 was marked by a free-falling currency, the lira, and record-high inflation. The government's monetary policy has sent the country into economic turmoil. And as Nick Schifrin reports, soaring prices have hurt Turks from all walks of life.
For 45-year-old Hasan Turan, the work never ends. He's made a living and supported his family as a janitor for 20 years. But these days, one job's not enough.
I'm trying to find a fourth apartment building to clean. The price increases have affected us a great deal, so I will have to take more jobs.
His newest additional job at a small grocery store in eastern Istanbul. He takes phone orders, picks produce for upper-middle-class customers, and delivers them on an electric scooter. This is his 15th hour of work today. Some days, he delivers 20 orders a day.
I'm struggling to make ends meet. The prices have gone up, so I had to take extra work. I'm doing a part-time job out of necessity.
It's a necessity just to feed his family. At the farmer's market, Hasan and his wife, Kimet, struggled with what to buy and what to leave.
Can we have a kilo of tangerines?
No, half a kilo will do. Let's buy just half a kilo.
1 pound of tangerines, 4 pounds of potatoes was all they could afford.
The prices are too high. I mean, we can't afford to buy all we need. In the past, I used to buy a lot, cook a lot. Now I have to buy in small quantities and try to get by.
Turkey is suffering its highest inflation in nearly two decades. From December 2020 to December 2021, prices rose more than 36%. Everything from food to gas. The economic crisis is everywhere. In December, bread lines stretched around the corner. And as the Turkish lira plunged, Turks around the country rushed to change money into U.S. dollars. But President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says it's all part of his plan.
Hopefully, we will eliminate this swelling as soon as possible and prevent our nation from being under the burden of unfair price increases.
The economic pain runs deep. Extensive borrowing and previous interest rate cuts were already driving up prices. But analysts say Erdogan's recent medicine is making the country sicker. Under his pressure, since September, Turkey's central bank slashed interest rates four times.
Anyone who took Econ 101 in college would know if your inflation climbs up, interest rates have to follow that. Erdogan is doing the opposite.
Soner Çaptay is the director of the Washington Institute's Turkish Research Program and author most recently of A Sultan in Autumn. He says Erdogan's motivation is difficult to know, but in the last few months of 2021, the lira lost almost half its value. In December, 18.4 for $1. And a weak lira can boost tourism and Turkish exports.
Erdogan is maybe trying to create what is called growth out of contraction. In other words, let the economy crash and burn, and that will make Turkish exports very affordable because the lira has lost its value, and the country will have a restored growth driven by strong export sector and also demand for Turkish tourism and services.
There are some signs of increased tourism. Last month, Bulgarians by the busload arrived in Istanbul to buy cheap groceries and bargain bizarre Christmas gifts. And Erdogan says exports are at an all-time high. Turkish authorities have also raised the minimum wage by 50%, and a new plan pays Turks to keep their bank deposits in lira. But the depreciation is still large, as is the anger. In November, protesters called for the government to resign and the police to back down.
How could the economic crisis become a political crisis?
If Erdogan does not restore economic growth, he's not going to win the next elections in 2023. We're going to see country's economic resilience push back and also a more unified opposition. So I would say this is the most important turning point in President Erdogan's career. The unusual part of it is that Turkey's citizens lived under Erdogan for nearly two decades and experienced prosperity that they'd never witnessed before. That income level and living standards is disappearing in front of the eyes of a lot of citizens. Voters are turning away from him.
And Erdogan's turning inward. He fired multiple officials who resisted his unorthodox economic policies, and his government filed criminal complaints against Turks who criticized his policies online.
At this stage, I think the only way for him to stick to power, looks like he's not going to be able to restore strong economic growth, is by becoming more autocratic only.
That boosts leading opposition figures like Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, who challenged Erdogan's nearly 20-year rule.
Şu andaki sürecin...
This current process is not merely an economic crisis. I want to underline that it is a political crisis. I see this as a reflection of the inability to run the country.
And it's hard to run a family. The Turans have cut back on food, cut out any new clothes, in order to afford one essential need, their daughter's tuition. 12-year-old Nisa is in middle school, and 19-year-old İrem is in college.
I can't say no to their needs because it is related with their education. They have to stay in school. We have to make personal sacrifices to meet their needs.
And maybe one day solve the country's crisis. İrem is studying economics. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Microsoft announced plans today to buy Activision Blizzard, a huge leader in video game development, in a deal valued at $75 billion. But the acquisition comes with significant issues. There have been numerous allegations of sexual misconduct in the Activision workplace. Jeff Bennett looks at those concerns and what is behind the deal.
Judy, thanks to video game subscriptions and the Xbox, Microsoft is already a major player in the gaming market, an industry generating $175 billion a year in revenue. But acquiring Activision will allow Microsoft to up its own game during a pandemic-fueled gaming boom. Activision is the company behind major hits like Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, and Candy Crush. And the takeover would make Microsoft the world's third largest gaming company. For more, we're joined by Kirsten Grind of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us. And if you can, put this number in context for us, this $175 billion, this $75 billion acquisition. What does it mean for the gaming industry generally?
It's huge. I mean, it's just one of the biggest deals, period. One of the biggest all-cash deals. And for the gaming industry, it really puts so much under one roof. So you had Xbox, and now you have Activision's hits that will be at Microsoft as well. So it gives Microsoft so much more might than it had before.
And Microsoft, which makes those Xbox consoles, it owns studios that produce hits like Minecraft. It's gotten more aggressive with gaming in the last several years. How does this acquisition play into their long-term strategy?
Right. Well, Activision has so many popular franchises. So with the addition of Activision there, I mean, as you said, they become the third largest gaming company by revenue worldwide. So it absolutely, you know, pending the deal's closure, makes them a very serious player in the space.
And this deal, as you know, and as you've reported, this is coming as Activision faces multiple regulatory investigations into alleged sexual assaults and mistreatment of female employees going back years. And just yesterday, Activision fired several of its own executives following its own investigation, its own review of what transpired. Give us a sense of what is happening within that company, and has Microsoft indicated how it will handle it moving forward?
That's right. Well, Activision is really, quite frankly, in trouble with its culture at this point. It's facing three regulatory investigations: the state of California, the EEOC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. We've reported about mishandling of some of the misconduct allegations. Its stock is down about 30% from the first of the lawsuits about its culture last summer. So it was facing pressure from employees, from shareholders. So this is a really, it's kind of a good solution really for Activision at this point.
And based on your reporting, I mean, do you know what happens to Activision's CEO, Bobby Kotick? He's led the company for more than three decades, but there were allegations that he was aware of some of these complaints of misconduct, harassment, even assault, but yet that he neglected to share it with the board.
That's right. We reported that in November, and that's actually kind of what led to Microsoft's approach when they were in the middle of all this turmoil after our story came out. And so Bobby actually is not expected to stay with the company after the deal closes. Again, these deals can take a very long time to close, and it's also pending a lot of regulatory approval. But yes, he's not expected to stay.
Can you give us a sense of the nature of what's been alleged?
Definitely. So some of the regulatory agencies have alleged sexual harassment, sexual assault, gender pay disparity, just a broad range of workplace misconduct across the board. What we wrote about in our November story in the Wall Street Journal was about how Bobby Kotick himself knew about some of these workplace misconduct allegations and didn't tell the board about them.
Big picture, as we wrap up our conversation here, this acquisition is almost akin to Disney acquiring Marvel back in 2012. Microsoft will now own a huge piece of the gaming industry, as we've been discussing. What does this mean for gamers generally?
You know, I think going back to the culture questions, I think this could be a very good thing for gamers. I think, you know, I heard a lot out there about how it was harder to get behind a company that was facing so many culture issues. And if a company like Microsoft can help turn that around, I think that would be good for everyone, frankly.
Kirsten Grein, thanks so much for your reporting and your perspectives on this major deal between Microsoft and Activision.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today, the first satellite images emerged of the Pacific nation of Tonga following Saturday's volcanic eruption. The photos show the islands coated in ash. Despite the violent explosion, the Tongan government has so far reported just three deaths. The status of two smaller islands in its chain is still unknown. John Yang takes a closer look at the science behind the volcano, its explosion, and aftermath.
Judy, scientists say the explosion revealed some of the mysteries of underwater volcanoes. It produced a tsunami that was felt on the coasts of Japan and the United States, 5,000 miles away, and triggered an oil spill in Peru. It set off a lightning storm that lasted 7 hours and had 400,000 strikes. It was heard as far away as Alaska. But for all the ways that made itself felt around the world, its damage was relatively confined. Tonga bore the brunt of the volcano's fury, blanketed with ash that's now contaminating its water supply. Michael Poland is a research geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington. Mr. Poland, thanks so much for joining us. As we talk about, there was so dramatic, this event, that huge plume that was visible from space, the tsunami, the atmospheric shockwave which rippled around the globe. But you say that the data actually show this was a relatively small eruption. Explain that.
Yeah, it's a very confounding event in that the amount of material that came out of the ground was not especially huge. It was perhaps the kind of thing we might see every few years from a volcano somewhere on Earth. But it produced an outsized explosion, really a massive explosion, and that has to have something to do with the interaction with ocean water. It produced that really massive tsunami. So it's having really outsized impacts for the amount of material that came out of the ground.
And what was in that material? What did come out of the ground?
Well, there was a lot of ash that came out, of course, as with most volcanic eruptions, and SO2 gas, among other types of gas, water vapor and so forth. And that sulfur dioxide really allows us to pinpoint where the plume is and how big it is, because we know roughly the amount of sulfur gas that's dissolved in the magma. So it's a bit like opening a soda and having that carbon dioxide come out of the soda. When the gas comes out of the volcano, we get a lot of SO2 that comes out of that magma. That allows us to track the plume and know roughly how big an eruption is.
And you talk about the reaction with the ocean water. Does that also, or what's the explanation for it being heard so far away, heard as far away as Alaska?
Yeah, that's really difficult to understand at this point. It had to have something to do with that sort of interaction, perhaps a large amount of gas-rich magma being suddenly exposed to cold ocean water generated just a really massive explosion. And it was heard, obviously, very, very far away. That's something I think is going to be the subject of an awful lot of research in the days, years to come.
And the tsunami, I think a lot of people's familiarity with tsunamis really comes from the 2004 Banda Aceh tsunami, which was the result of an earthquake, of a seismic event. Is this common, a tsunami also common with volcanic eruptions underwater like this?
The volcanic eruptions that are right underwater or right near the water can generate tsunamis. It's not something we see a lot of. Certainly, we see the earthquake-induced tsunamis much more commonly. There's a lot of study that went into earthquake-induced tsunami, especially after 2004, and we've come to understand those sorts of processes a lot better than we did before. But volcanic tsunamis being rare give us fewer opportunities to study them. And so we don't understand the volcanic tsunamis quite as well. So a bit like that airwave that traveled around the Earth, this tsunami is also going to be studied quite intently to understand more about what generated it. Was it some displacement of the seafloor? Was it perhaps the impact of an ash plume on the water? There are many potential mechanisms for why this tsunami was so big, and understanding that is going to be key to being able to forecast these sorts of events in the future.
As I hear you talk, it sounds like there's a lot we don't understand about underwater volcanoes, and that this is suggesting ways or new research, as you say, to examine this one. What sorts of things will you be looking at and your colleagues be looking at it in this event?
I think the key here is that magma-water interaction. And so there's going to be all kinds of attention paid to how magma and water interact. What happens when you put these two different materials in contact with another, really in a dynamic way? So we're going to be looking at modeling studies of those sorts of interactions, studying the ash particles to see whether that can provide some clues as to how the interaction took place, and then modeling this explosion, modeling the tsunami to try to understand more about the nature of this interaction. Because obviously there are submarine volcanoes in other places. They're tremendously hard to study because they are obscured. It's relatively easy to study volcanoes on land compared to these underwater volcanoes. But clearly they present a hazard, so we need to understand more about that hazard. This event, as tragic as it is for Tonga, might help us understand these kinds of interactions in more detail, and that'll help us in the future.
It's fascinating stuff. Research geophysicist Michael Poland, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tanya Marie Jordani founded Nourish NYC, an organization that began with the goal of providing support to Black Lives Matter protesters and has grown to provide broader grassroots services to her community year-round. Tonight, she shares her brief but spectacular take on building a community based on love.
I've been protesting, like, physically since I was a young child with my mom. It's really funny, I don't call myself an activist because this is just a way of life. Nourish NYC, in short, is a community organization that is Black-led, Black-centered, and we practice a holistic approach to community care. I started Nourish NYC on May 29th, 2020, in my best friend's bedroom. That was the evening after the very first protest in this wave of protesting, of Black Lives Matter protesting after George Floyd was killed. People were hungry, people were getting hurt, scraping themselves, but nobody had PPE, nobody had first aid, nobody had water bottles to share. When I got home that evening, I looked for organizations to donate money to who were providing PPE, snacks, and water to protesters, but I couldn't find any, and that's how I started Nourish NYC. I just started to post on my Twitter and my personal Instagram, and then it grew really, really fast. I went from having like 1,000 followers to almost 10,000. Within like 3 days, I had like $80,000 in my accounts. And I knew it wasn't going to stop there. And I looked at it and I said, I have an opportunity to really do something with this money. That has been an opportunity to provide over 40,000 meals, to provide over 10,000 safety kits to protesters. It's been an opportunity to connect Black trans people with therapy. It's been an opportunity to keep people housed. It's been an opportunity to keep people fed, to get people clothed, to help Hurricane Ida victims, to help people who are just struggling to make rent. It's been an opportunity to make a difference in so many people's lives, and even if it's one person, to me that's success. And so when I saw my bank account just growing and growing and growing, I was like, no. People like me, we deserve the opportunity to call the shots instead of them always being called for us. In 2019, I was sexually assaulted. And this is kind of like where the idea for having these spaces that take our marginalization and our traumas in mind, but that center joy, came from. All I wanted was a space to go that understood what I was experiencing with people who were trauma-informed, to go be happy. I just wanted to go and like create around other people who were going through the same thing that I was navigating, and it just doesn't exist. And so Nourish is my opportunity to create that space. When you don't have your basic needs met, you can't show up for yourself in the way that you want to. And I just don't think that that's a way to live. I don't think that's a way that anyone should have to live. I deserve the opportunity, and people who are like me, who have experiences like me, deserve the opportunity to control our stories. We deserve to feel joy uninhibited. We deserve to smile uninhibited. We deserve to dance. We deserve to eat. We deserve to feast together happily. My name is Tanya Marie Jordani, and this is my brief but spectacular take on living in a world based on love.
Such a powerful story, and you can watch all of our brief but spectacular episodes at pbs.org/newshour/brief. Also on the NewsHour online right now, fatal drug overdoses spiked to a record high in the U.S. during the first year of the pandemic. You can read more about what experts say needs to happen to change course. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.